Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. The Engineering Room series is sponsored by Equal Experts, and I'd like to thank them for their ongoing support. So if you'd like some help building some great software or are interested in finding a great place to work, please do check out their links in the description below. My guest today is a software developer, architect, and technical leader who helps teams and organizations to break down complexity and finding new perspectives from which to view their systems. She currently works for ThoughtWorks, a former employer of mine too, and has spent her whole professional career so far in software delivery consulting, giving her that consultant's huge benefit of getting to see many organizations and teams succeed and fail at delivering software in lots of different ways. Birgitta regularly speaks and writes about software-related topics, most notably architecture, cultivation, and governance, pair programming as a catalyst for high-performing teams and diversity in the technology industry. But she also has a new job at ThoughtWorks of global lead for AI-assisted software delivery. And as part of that, has been leading some really interesting activities that we hope to learn more about today. Please welcome Birgitta Buckler.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for coming and talking to us today. I think that AI is certainly one of those topics of the moment, and I hear every opinion from that it's all hype and we'll just be forgotten next year to welcome to our new AI overlords. So where do you stand on this spectrum? Do you think this is, as many people have said, the most important invention in human history, or is it just another fad?
Yeah, I think, what people often try to compare it to, and we're all still a bit traumatized from the blockchain hype, I think, yeah. Right? I guess I'm starting off with a controversial topic, but so the thing about the blockchain hype that almost always struck me was that I couldn't quite find a way out of, you know, the inherent thing that, you know, the technology was about decentralized consensus, and that would always be slow. And I just couldn't see the technical ways out of that to improve that. Whereas with this AI trend, there are certain weaknesses today, things that, you know, don't work as people would like them to work. But I can see lots of technical avenues to improve that and to mitigate some of those weaknesses. So that's, like, for me, one of the big differences in terms of, like, the potential, you know, in terms of, like, oh, is it just going to be the same thing? It's just going to, like, disappear, right? And so there's, of course, you know, I often start also my presentations with, like, a slide showing the Gartner hype cycle, you know, where you always have this, like, peak of inflated expectations, I think that top point is called, right? And that's certainly where generative AI, at least generative AI, is right now.
Yeah.
And also what Gartner, I think, calls AI augmented software engineering. So, you know, or what I currently call AI assisted software delivery, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it, right? And it's both at that top peak. And a few months ago, a colleague reminded me that the higher the peak is, the bigger the hangover is going to be when things go down into the trough of disillusionment. Am I pronouncing that right? Trough. Yeah.
Trough.
So yeah. So the higher this hype is in terms of, like, oh, you know, next year I only need 50% of my engineers, right? Yeah. The bigger the hangover is going to be. But at the same time, you know, even if we're all anchored on the 50%, and then suddenly think 10% is not good, or, you know, whatever 10% means, we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
But it's still, like, we can get value out of this, and there's already value today, like, with all the, you know, warts that it might have, but you can already see practical value today in, like, real life engineering teams. So I'm of course, like, specifically talking about using AI for software, because that's what I've been kind of, like, doing full time for 8 or 9 months now.
Yeah. As we were discussing before we started recording, I'm kind of interested in the philosophical implications of this change as well. And before we narrow to the software, just to put my position, my position into focus is that I can't really understand people that are just looking at this at hype. It seems to me that already some of the stuff that's being that the generative AI is capable of in narrow spheres is already so disruptive to our whole society and you know and our lives online. It's an enormous change in terms of capability and impact. Being able to search crowds of people for an individual and follow them around is a kind of dystopian nightmare, potentially. You know, just that. And that's driven by these kinds of machine learning techniques.
I'm sometimes glad that I'm just focusing on this one area of application, because I do actually think that it is one of the most promising ones. And it also doesn't have quite as many of the like disturbing and ethical implications as other areas of AI. You know, I don't have to think about the impact of spam and, you know, fake news and all of that, right? So the biggest critical topics probably in the software space is also, of course, copyright and copyleft and, you know, kind of like mining, you know, the contributions of like open communities. So from the last decades, you know, that's one of the things. And of course, we have to think about quality and all of those things. But that's, again, like engineering topics, right? That's actually interesting to like revisit. It like we always do when the new big trend comes around, like how are we doing things today and could we now actually do them differently because we have new tools, right? So it's like more a little bit more down to earth, and I don't have to think about as many of the bad implications compared to other areas.
And I think you're absolutely right. Both of us are probably better placed to be talking about that stuff rather than the general stuff. So where do you see the role of AI in software development? I suppose now and in the future, because in many ways we're just on the first steps, realistically of wherever it's going to go.
Yeah, I mean the biggest and most obvious area, and also the one that is the most explored at the moment, is of course to assist us in coding, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's already real today, right? Like we're seeing more and more organizations adopt this, like also big enterprises, in spite of like some initial, you know, data and code confidentiality concerns. So that's already real. Like when I started using GitHub Copilot is definitely the incumbent to beat at the moment. It's the most mature product at the moment. And when I started using it, I was like, I was skeptical at first, but I was really impressed, and I felt like it was almost immediately giving me a boost. Like, you know, with all the caveats of like, you know, I've been programming for over 20 years, that might be a different situation than, you know, for somebody with a different kind of experience. But I kind of had my plan in my head of what I wanted to build. And Copilot was just filling in a lot of the blanks for me and was helping me more often than not. So it was really, really impressive. And there's, in that sense, not that much of a learning curve. In that sense, you know, you can just start using it. Like you just, it might slow you down because you have to kind of get used to this new type of software that's not always helping you. And we're not used to that as engineers, right? You use the you like the term engineering, right? Like engineers, right? So, and we're not used to that, this non-deterministic output, right? So we have to get used to that, put our hand on the hot stove a few times and maybe get led down the wrong path, right? So that might slow us down a bit, but I felt like it was hardly slowing me down at all in the sense of like using a new tool that I first have to learn, because I also got benefit out of it almost immediately.
Could you kind of characterize some of those benefits for us? Just paint the picture of where you saw that value.
So the first thing was just like being faster. Definitely not the only thing, but it was being faster. So it was like a code base I was working on that I was quite familiar with, in a tech stack that I was familiar with. And it was kind of like what I was just saying before, it was filling in the blanks for me. So for example, I was writing a new function, and I was actually seeing, oh, let's see if this thing can create a test for me. And it was very impressive how it was actually picking up on my test setup that was already in the test suite, and kind of like even setting up really reasonable test data for me, and also coming up with the right expectations. So I had to double check this, right? I had to review. You have to review a lot more than before, which can get tiring. But it was really making me faster also in suggesting test data, all of this like boilerplate stuff. And then the other thing is access to knowledge does more in my natural IDE workflow, right? And this is goes particularly in the direction of having a chat in your IDE. So it's like a very important feature of these coding assistants as well, not just this autocomplete on steroids. And that was, because I'm now more working in this AI area than before, I'm writing a lot more Python code, which I haven't really ever done that much before. And so I'm asking Copilot questions like, are there static functions in Python? Because I don't know. And I get the answer a lot quicker in the IDE than going to a browser. On the flip side of that, so I've been using Python now for 7-8 months, and I probably still couldn't, like, from a blank page, give you the syntax for some very simple things. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say I need to do a flat mapping or map reduce type of thing on a list or something. I probably couldn't, like, spell it out because I always use Copilot to do it.
Yeah.
The question is that a problem or not? You know. Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember when electronic calculators first became popular, and people used to complain that it would stop everybody being able to do mental arithmetic, which I'm pretty sure it did mostly. So yeah. I certainly reach for a calculator when I need to do other than very simple maths.
Yeah. And I mean, having said that, so there's definitely these benefits, but there are also, of course, risks, right? Like, yeah. I mean, these tools are trained on public code, right? Yeah. And as we all know, the code that is public on the internet is not like the bar that we should hold ourselves to, right? It's a lot of like these like quick little experiments that somebody puts up on GitHub, or, you know, it's a lot of framework code as well, like open source libraries, whereas like at least I usually work on like enterprise business application code, right? Which is also a different type of code, right? So it's not necessarily representative of what we're writing. There's like potential for bugs, you know, once we start trusting it too much or we're tired of reviewing its code, we might get complacent. There's lots been written about security flaws, right? There is also this like hypothesis, and there are some like first signs for that your code bases might start growing faster than they usually would, because it's easier to create new code than to change existing code, because the AI is not very good at refactoring yet. Or your pull request sizes or overall change set size might increase because you're like building larger chunks of code at the same time, which of course, you know, increases your deployment risk to production and, you know, might make it harder for you to find causes of like errors, and then your mean time to restore goes up, and, you know, so there's all kinds of risks as well, of course. And but I still think it's like an exciting time, so I think it's here to stay. It's already useful, we'll get better. So now as a profession, we have to figure out like how do our practices change, or what are new practices, so that we can deal with this in a way that we get the benefits and avoid the pitfalls.
So much in there, that so many threads that are interesting to explore in there. One of them that you kind of touched on a few times is that you and me even more so have been writing code for a very long time. So we're coming at it from a different perspective than a junior developer, say. So do you think there's a difference in the experience of using these AI tools and the value of the AI tools, depending on the level of experience of the developer? How does that play out from what you've seen?
Yeah, there's definitely a difference. Like, I was just describing the types of benefits I get as an experienced developer, right? And I was also giving almost like a hybrid example of where I, as an experienced person, was using something that I was not experienced with.
Yes.
But I still have like all the very strong mental model of the concepts in my head. So that's, again, like a very different...
You know that you want to look for a map reduce, yeah.
Exactly. I know the terminology. I know to use words like argument or signature or, you know, all of these like mental models, right? I think where the potential is a lot more for less experienced developers is in the learning part. And actually, just coincidentally, just today at lunch here in the office, I was talking to one of my colleagues who is like an almost full-time university professor teaching mm-hmm. people coding. And he was telling me about how he introduces his students to it, and he's not forbidding them to use it. He just has certain rules around like transparency, how to use it. And he's asking them a lot, like, what are you using it for? And they're using it to learn, like, to, you know, for example, they have ChatGPT ask them questions to, you know, and to kind of check their understanding, almost like a tutor, right?
Yes.
And I also think there's this, like, let's say you're as a learner, you know, you come across Docker for the first time, you don't know what it is, right? You can, of course, read like on some definition, like what Docker is, but usually it takes some extra time to figure out, but how does it apply to my current situation, to the thing that I'm currently working on, right? That's usually like the next step that's a lot harder. And that's also a lot harder to Google, right? Like, because then you have to describe your situation. But now you have this tool that knows language so well and that can actually connect this concept of Docker with my situation when I describe it, right? So that gives me a whole different learning experience. And again, almost like a type of tutor that I can ask questions.
So I guess that also brings the other obvious question. If that idea of kind of the AI tools as a kind of mentor with infinite patience in the context of your work is quite a nice one, a nice way of thinking about that. But you've already hinted at some of the differences that might get in the way. So what are the downsides? What are the problems that make it problematic? You know, what are the difficulties that we need to be wary of?
Yeah, I was already talking about the quality of the code that the models know about, right? So I always say it, generative AI amplifies indiscriminately, right? Like it just sees what it sees. It doesn't know what's good or bad. It just suggests it to you. Same in your code base, right? Like tools like GitHub Copilot are actually picking up on open files. And, you know, not all the files you have open have the code that you want to be amplified, right? Yeah. So that's the quality part. Then another downside is, of course, that same as with natural language, when I'm just asking ChatGPT to help me to write something or asking ChatGPT about facts, the same thing with these models for coding and these coding assistants, they very confidently hallucinate, and not just confidently, but in a way that sounds very plausible.
Yeah.
So, and I've also been like led down the wrong path a few times where just the detail just wasn't right. Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can actually... One time the first time I asked it to generate mermaid.js diagram code for me, I just couldn't get it to render. And I thought I was doing something wrong in my IDE to render it. And then I realized it's totally the wrong syntax for a class diagram.
Yeah.
And I just gave it an example from the mermaid.js website. Yeah. And it was like, oh, I apologize for the inconvenience. And immediately applied that example to my situation, which then was very impressive.
Again. Yeah, yeah.
But it's just like kind of constant little vigilance that you have to have as a developer.
That seems to me also that one of the tricks is the wrong word, but techniques to learning to take advantage of these new tools in all sorts of different domains is they work so much better when you can give them more information about the context of your work. And so, you know, you can give them, you know, if you want them to generate writing, you want a style of your writing. If you want them to write code, you want them to generate, you know, samples of what you think are representative of your style of writing code and so on, so that they can,
and
that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I've been writing a little bit about my experience and the experiences of my colleagues on martinfowler.com.
Mm-hmm.
And one memo I wrote there was about how to think about this this trait of large language models. Like, how do I deal with that? Like, when do I trust it? When do I not trust it? And one thing I was thinking about, I mean, we always say, oh, we shouldn't anthropomorphize an AI, right? But at the same time can also be useful, right? Because these types of things, like as humans, we are actually quite good at like getting a feeling for when do I trust a colleague, when do I not trust them, because I might know their background, what they, you know, I know this person does not have a technical background, so I might not trust them when they explain Docker to me or, you know? So I was thinking maybe there's like some character we can come up with in our heads, like that's this team member who's very eager to please, you know, who has read all of the books in the world, but has no experience, you know, and also, you know, doesn't want to admit that when they're not right, you know, kind of this kind of like character on the team. And that might actually give us like a, you know, a more intuitive approach.
I've worked with some people like that.
Sorry?
I've worked with some people like that.
So I was thinking more in the article, I came up with like a cartoon character, like you know, because I don't want people to like associate with a particular person. Right. Yeah, but
I was just being flippant, but I think that's a good idea because although it's probably wise not to anthropomorphize these things too much. One of the things about them is that things like these haven't existed in the world before. And so we don't have mental models for how to characterize them and position them. They're not the same as other things.
Yeah.
And they are in many ways, in exactly the kinds of ways that you just described, they are in many ways, they're more like us than like traditional machines.
Mm, yeah. And one of my favorite articles about this that I keep quoting all the time is by Ethan Mollick, who the title is, I think, AI is not good software, it is pretty good people.
Yeah.
And he's actually saying in the article that AI is terrible software in the sense of what I was saying before, like it's not like other software we're using.
Yeah.
And I see this a lot when I try to collect feedback from developers about using coding assistants, what is, you know, what works well, what doesn't work well. And often there's like a baseline of expectations that this is like a code generator.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, it doesn't work for that. And it doesn't work for that. So it's bad. And then I'm like, yeah, but like how many, you know, is it helping you more than it's not helping you, which is not like a kind of like evaluation approach that we're used to. Usually we want to know, does it work or does it not work?
Yeah.
Right? Red, green. But here it's kind of like, does it work more than it, you know, harms you or it does not work? Right. So we're not used to that.
So in your work at ThoughtWorks of looking at the impact of software on software development, have you been doing specific research or are you mining practice from projects and that kind of thing? How does that play out? And what things are you finding, I guess? I think you've already described some of your recommendations.
Yeah. So we're like a consulting company and, you know, not necessarily, you know, have the infrastructure to do these types of like very structured like research projects with like different teams, right? And as we both know, like also comparing two teams to each other, one with assistants, one without, is very hard to do because the two teams never are working on exactly the same thing. They always have different skills, all of that, right? So it was more like we try to put these tools, especially the coding assistant, in the hands of as many of our consultants as possible. And ideally also in the context of real work, right? So we try to work with our clients to make these tools available, you know, to kind of talk through the confidentiality concerns and all of those things, right? Because, you know, it's very different working on a real existing code base than working on, you know, a few little like sample projects or something, right?
Yeah.
So because, you know, I have this full-time role, like part of my responsibilities is to kind of like talk to people and, you know, find the things that work and that don't work and how developers are adopting it. And of course, the favorite question of the day, what is the impact on team metrics, right? Or the question is usually more like, what is the impact on productivity? And it's also kind of like hard to collect it in a structured way because people use it for all kinds of things. It's, you know, it's like for creating tests, for creating code, for upskilling, like I was saying, for, you know, they're trying to use it for like tech stack migrations, like, you know, from one test framework to another or from Angular 1 to React or, you know, so it's just generating documentation, of course, like asking questions about a code base. So there's so many different applications that are possible.
Have you looked at my favorite metrics on the whole are the DORA metrics in terms of being useful tools to measure those kinds of things. Have you come across anybody attempting to measure those, kind of a benchmark those before and after?
So I've been going around, like what I've done in a structured way is go around and ask teams, you know, what metrics are you measuring on your team right now? You know, and did you see any impact that could really be traced back to the coding assistant on those metrics, right? Because also, you know, how we measure our outcomes doesn't change just because we have a new tool, right? So I was asking them, what are you measuring? Did you see any impact? And it's actually really hard to trace any impact directly to the coding assistant, unsurprisingly, maybe, right? Because there's just so many dimensions and factors going on. But it's, you know, I think one thing is about thinking about the ballpark, right? I was, I think, mentioning before that some people are shopping around this number of like 50% productivity improvement, whatever that means, 50% productivity, right?
Yeah.
But if you just think about the ballpark and think about, let's say 40% of a team's story cycle time is spent on coding, which is very high, actually, right? Let's say 40%. Let's say in 60% of the cases, they can use a coding assistant and it's suitable for the type of work they're doing because it's not always suitable.
Yeah.
And then whenever they use a coding assistant, they're 50% faster. If you do that calculation, you get to a ballpark of around 10% potential impact on the cycle time, the story cycle time.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've probably seen a bunch of story cycle graphs in your time, right?
Yeah.
And they usually go, I mean, you know, just on the audio you can see it, but my finger is kind of going up and down, like a, you know, oscillating line right now, because it goes up and down, the variance is quite high, right? So my hypothesis right now is that we will, at least at the state of that things are right now, we will not be able to prove really hard with hard numbers on paper. This is actually making us faster, right? The coding assistant, which is like why I'm getting worried that some companies might actually say, oh, I don't see this like black on white, so we're just going to like stop using it again, stop spending money on it, right? But a lot of this is about the developer experience, right? And the key metric here is to ask the developers, is this making your work better, right? And to actually believe that. And my colleague Eric Dernenburg always makes like an analogy to the times when IntelliJ and the JetBrains IDE products weren't as successful as they are today yet. And many companies and many of our clients didn't want to pay for them.
Yeah.
But Thoughtworks really believed that this is the superior IDE and it really makes our services better. So we paid the licenses for our consultants. And now actually most companies are doing it because they understood the benefit of this, right?
Yeah.
So I expect something similar to happen maybe with Copilot as well.
Yeah. So you're talking about the impact on coding there, and that's clearly where these things are at the moment. But there's an awful lot more to the job of software development than that. And and so where do you think these tools have an impact on those other parts of the work? And if so, where?
Yeah, so this is definitely the area that is less explored with real world experience in the industry right now, I would say. And so we're actually working right now on experimenting with a few things there with some of our clients on almost like a team assistant, right? Like helping the whole team in all of the tasks other than coding that they have to do. And the idea is kind of this, I mean, in the context of large language models, people talk a lot about knowledge, right? And knowledge amplification, like this is a new way to give people access to knowledge in a very different way than like a search on Confluence or something, right? I was talking about the ability to apply something to your situation before, right? And then the other thing is that you can use prompts to codify the practices, right? So you can, I always like, like to show an example of like using it for threat modeling, for example, which is a practice that many teams kind of like procrastinate, mm-hmm. like to do. It's maybe anything security related is kind of scary, right? And like, how do I do it, right? I can read an article, but that's kind of theoretical. So, but you can kind of write a prompt, like somebody in the organization who knows threat modeling well can write a prompt to kind of write instructions how you do it. And then somebody on a team can use that prompt to apply it or to prepare at least a threat modeling session in the context of the team, right? So for example, threat modeling, there's this stride approach where you have these different categories of attack vectors, right? Like tampering with input is the T, and the, you know, I forget the at the moment, but it kind of takes me through, you know, brainstorming scenarios in each of those areas for my particular application flow and architecture, right?
Yeah.
And this is not like, it's kind of like a different angle in terms of like making the team better or faster. It's not like with coding where people talk a lot about speed, because something like threat modeling, you don't do that every day, right? So it's not a big lever that suddenly I can create this artifact faster, right? But it's more about, as I said, amplifying the knowledge, helping people upskill faster, and also potentially reducing waste later, right?
Sorry, I'm putting words into your mouth, but would you regard that as kind of adding some artificial expertise to grow the expertise of the team? That's what it sounded like you were describing.
Yeah, artificial expertise. Yeah, I like that. And yeah. I mean, threat modeling is maybe a little exotic example as well, but you can apply the same thing to user story writing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a much more common task on the team, right? Yeah. So one thing we do in this little tool that we're using is also turn the tables and have the AI ask me questions, right?
Yeah.
Let's say I have a user story and maybe I'm having a busy day. I just feel like I can't think. I have one sentence, this is the feature I want, or the user story.
Yeah.
I put that sentence in. The tool maybe has already like a prepared description of my domain, so I don't have to repeat that all the time. And then it starts asking me questions.
Yeah.
Does this work for all customer types, or does it only work for specific customer types? Mm-hmm. What happens when people try to do this with a date that is in the past? You know, kind of these types of questions that help me kind of find gaps in my thinking. That otherwise, you know, maybe I would have taken the user story, went into a planning session, and it would have been the first three questions the developers ask me. And I'm like, oh yeah, I have to ask the stakeholder first.
Yeah.
Let's adjourn this meeting. And you have this like ping pong and rework, right? These sources of waste, right? Whereas if you have like a, you know, how did you call it? Artificial expertise.
Artificial expertise, yeah.
Brainstorming partner earlier on, I can potentially improve the comprehensiveness of my artifact, right? It shouldn't replace a team collaboration at all, of course, hopefully.
Yeah.
But I can, especially in remote times where it's harder to kind of see if somebody's available for a quick brainstorm, right? Yeah. I have this extra little partner, the same with the code.
That's really intriguing. That it also aligns with one of the ideas that quite nicely with one of the ideas that I've had about one of the uses. I've done a little bit of play. I've nowhere near as much as you. I've done a little bit of playing, largely on very small toy truck, you know, toy projects. But one of the things that I kind of noticed was that in GitHub Copilot, if people haven't used it, you can add comments and start describing what it is that you want to build, and it will start writing code for you to build that thing. And what that reminded me of was my approach to BDD, where I'm trying to capture the behaviors of my system in small user observable increments and build a series of executable specifications in effect. And it felt an awful lot like, to me, like the same kind of level of abstraction that I was needing to undertake to try and explain to the AI what I wanted the code to do. And that made me think about this thing about, you know, what's coming, what are the next generation of AI tools going to be like to help us do that? I think
and
that's
the number. That's kind of still the, you know, sometimes there's this hope, oh, cool, this can now like generate all these things for us, right?
Yeah.
But it's often many of our artifacts in software delivery, it's also about the journey to the artifact, right? Because software delivery is still very much a team sport as long as AI cannot do 100% of the things.
Absolutely. And that gets me to another thing that was going through my head when earlier in the conversation that we haven't got to yet, which for me is key. One of the things that seems really alien to me about the AIs, and certainly what feels like a discontinuity with my interaction with the AI tools when I use them, is that my approach is massively incremental. You know, my approach to all of it is iterative and collaborative, and I'm going to make progress in small steps. And I genuinely don't believe that you can build complex systems any other way. AIs don't really work like that. They kind of make a giant leap guess and say, here's your answer. And as you said, they're not very good at refactoring, but that's hugely more important in building big, complicated systems than your initial guess. Because otherwise, you've got to get it perfectly right first time. And however smart the AIs are, the chances of ever doing that are slimmer than having a lot of shots at getting it right. So the ability, when they're able to learn and iterate and change their minds and change direction, that seems like that's going to be a huge step, it seems to me, at some point. They don't work like that at all yet.
Yeah, and I would say one thing is that is exactly like, same as I said, it's still about team collaboration.
Yeah.
It's the iterative things. And that's often something that is left out when there's like a more simplified view on it. And people just see, oh, I need documentation, so I can just generate it. I need code, I can just generate it, right? But kind of like forgetting these parts. On the other hand, it's actually interesting because for these types of tasks that I was talking about, or generally tasks like, you know, writing a user story or breaking down an epic or helping you write an architecture decision record and trying to nudge you in the direction where you actually talk about why you're making the decision, what you need, right? All of those things, like, it's usually, you usually get better results if you get the AI to go in small steps as well.
Yes.
So, a lot of the prompts that we're using kind of are written in this way that you're going step by step so that the user can always like intervene and always sanity check the work, right? And check the work like, oh no, you misunderstood that. I don't need that domain object, or I don't need that data, please correct. And then you move on to the next step, right?
Yeah.
So that's like an interesting thing, but that doesn't apply to the refactoring problem, of course.
Yeah. And that, when you think about what it takes to be able to do something like refactoring, you come to a new code base and, you know, change it for the better. There's quite a lot of implicit stuff going on there, and it's hard to imagine without being able to select good code examples to show the AI.
and so on.
We can say the same for human beings, really. Yeah. It's a difficult, that kind of design, sense of good design, sense of quality in the solutions is a very hard thing to learn, it seems.
And you're actually hitting on a very important point there that I wanted to mention earlier as well with the user story. So we actually just released a podcast episode on the ThoughtWorks Technology podcast about AI and refactoring, and we had Adam Thornhill on from CodeScene, because you were talking about you need a lot of examples of what good code looks like.
Yeah.
And that is what CodeScene as a company, they have this product for code health monitoring and also code health improvement. And they have that. They have all of this data about code smells and good looking code. So they actually did a lot of experiments with like getting large language models to refactor code, and found that they were only successful in like, I don't know, 30-35% of the cases or something. And then they took their data and other types of machine learning and other types of algorithms and put like kind of like a confidence check behind it, and said, you know, always discard this if, you know, if it doesn't improve the quality or it changes the behavior.
Yeah.
And so their kind of like data is really helping them there. And that's like, this, like, it sometimes feels like data quality doesn't matter as much with large language models, because it feels like, oh, I can make a spelling error. It doesn't mind. And it's unstructured data and it's fuzzy, right? But the content of the data still very much matters. And that's the same, like, when you're trying to build something for user story writing or other delivery tasks. How do you orchestrate the context that you give the AI so it can best help you? Which data do you feed it? Which do you not want to feed it because it's outdated? How do you explain to it that there are two words in the domain that mean different things? Yeah. You know, so it's still very much just about that. It's not just as easy as like asking, like just throwing your Confluence at it and asking it any questions and getting magical results.
That's certainly one of the things that I've said several times in recent years about the AI tools is, and this is based on me playing with them early on, I suppose, is that, you know, they're guessing at the code. They don't actually run the code. And so I've definitely seen outputs that were syntax, as you pointed out with your example, I've definitely seen examples where they were just syntactically incorrect. Mm. Presumably at some point, as we're getting more into multimodal AIs and so on, the tools will begin running the code that they write. And I think you mentioned earlier, I can't remember whether that was before we started recording or after, but that testing and the importance of testing is doesn't go away because the AIs are writing some of the code.
Yeah.
And that... I think there's a lot of naivety around what that means from my point of view often, which I'm kind of interested in talking about.
Yeah. And it's, I don't think it's as much about multimodal models. Maybe like I'm not like a data scientist or like I don't know about some of those developments, but I think it's about combining large language models with other technology that understands code and can analyze code and can run code as well, right? And then we're also getting into the direction of agents, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there was recently a lot of noise around this coding assistant called Devin, right? Which is basically, using like agents, little agents that, you know, first it tries to quote unquote reason about what you need to do to solve the user's problem.
Yeah.
And then it can use the terminal, it can use the code editor, it can use Git to commit things, right? So it's all of these little agents that the AI is using. So there's, for example, a paper by, I think it's Meta. I hope I'm not wrong, but they built like tooling internally and experimented with it to enhance their existing test suites with more tests. And then they were doing exactly that. They had the LLM generate a test, and then they were running kind of like a pipeline that was first checking, does this compile? Then it was checking, is the test green? Then they check, does it increase the test coverage? And only if it fulfilled all of those steps, it would create a pull request. And then still a human would look at it, right? But, or there's, so some of my colleagues at the moment are playing around with, you know, large language models and AI and the potential for legacy modernization.
Yeah.
And by legacy, I mean COBOL and such, right? They're also trying to combine, again, the Gen AI with other things. Like they're using tools that can actually analyze the dependencies of the COBOL code base as well and get meta information and then load that into a knowledge graph in a graph database and then use that as an additional data source that the AI can use when it's answering the questions. So it's actually in that case much more of a search problem and again a data and context orchestration problem than it is, you know, a large language model thing. In the end, the large language model will give me a human answer, but the heavy lifting is actually done by other things.
I must admit there's bits of that make me a little bit nervous in terms of this what seems to me like a naive view of what testing's about and for. I'm, as you know, I'm a long-time TDD enthusiast and practitioner, and I think that it's much more important than only just the testing. Testing's really a nice output from TDD, but it's not the only thing. And the thing that makes me nervous of things like Meta were trying with boosting the testing, that might be a useful thing to do. I can imagine situations, particularly in legacy code bases, where you want to stabilize it. I can imagine that's a useful to have AI tools generate some tests that just stabilize the situation. But what we're talking about then really is approval testing. We're saying, is it still the same? Is it still doing the same things?
Regression, yeah.
Yeah, that's not the same thing as what test-driven development gives you.
It drives
design choices and helps you understand the problems better and leads you to better design and all of that kind of thing. And
I'm actually glad you're bringing this up because it gives me an opportunity to talk about generating tests just briefly again.
Yeah.
Because I was just like offhandedly mentioning this before as an example. You're trying to generate a test, right? But of course, there's a whole conversation to be had about like, is it a good idea to let the AI generate a test for you and your implementation?
Yeah.
And which order should you be doing it, right? And so I think in terms of like the time horizon and our practices, TDD is probably one of the early ones that would be affected by this, because it's just too tempting to let the AI generate tests for you, because it's actually, as I was saying, it's actually quite good at it. So if people are going to do it anyway, getting some.
But that's my problem is that it's good at generating bad tests.
Yeah. So I think we need to think about, again, as a profession, like what is TDD 2.0 in this sense, right?
Yeah.
So is the workflow, maybe let's say I have a new function that I'm writing, is then maybe the recommendation or like the practice, you know, when you have a new function, always write the first 2-3 tests manually and do this test driving, right? So that you even have testable code in the first place as well, right?
Yeah.
And you drive the design and, you know, journey is the destination. And then maybe for your edge cases and to kind of like enhance that, you use the AI to help you cover that. And then maybe you also need like a bunch of like recommendations, how you actually make sure that the tests are effective, that they will actually fail when the code is broken, right?
And aren't too tightly coupled to the solution, which I think is the commonest anti-pattern of unit testing afterwards.
Yeah.
And is almost inevitable. If you point an AI at some code, it's a self-referential system. The AI is looking at the code and it says, that's what I've got to test. What you've got to test is the behavior that code is supposed to exhibit. What if that code doesn't exhibit the behavior? You're going to be testing. The test will be passing and telling you that it's all good when it doesn't do what you want it to do.
Mm. Yeah, that actually gives me a new idea. I hadn't thought about that yet because you were saying anti-pattern, right? And the word pattern is always like a key word when you're looking for use cases, right?
So
is there maybe a way to tell the AI, you know, look for this anti-pattern of like when the test tests the implementation and not the, you know, is there a way for it to recognize that and to warn you? Like maybe in some cases it's wrong, but in the cases where it's right, it actually helps me, you know?
I think there are certainly some very small scale patterns that you could teach an AI. So don't test private methods. Don't break encapsulation of the code, those sorts of things. That's certainly a starting point. But I think I like the thing that you said very early on in the conversation when you said that in some uses it's helpful to get the AI to ask the questions.
Mm.
But a place where I imagine it would be really interesting for it to help you with test-driven development would be for it to look at the code and then said, is this code meant to do this? And tell you what the code's meant to achieve. And if that's right, then it could generate a test for you from that.
Mm.
But starting off looking at the code and writing a test to validate that the code does what the code does seems like a redundant step to me. It's not quite useless. There are places where it's useful, but it's not very useful. It's not the same thing as specifying the behavior. It's the BDD thing. It's tests as specification rather than as test.
Yeah.
I climbed up onto my hobby horse there. I think it's a big deal, and I think that self-referential thing is a problem, because you're going to end up with just creating crap really fast.
Yeah. And like with all areas in code, it's also about like the type of test, right? Like how critical is this? How complex is this?
Yeah.
Is this just like, I was talking to a quality analyst colleague of mine the other day, and he kept talking about slop which was an English word that I didn't know yet, but kind of like the boilerplate, kind of like very regular stuff that you just like quickly put down, right?
Yeah.
That's very different from like more complex tests, or like you have that, like some like rich behavior that you want to test, right? So again, like with all things, we also have to look at the type and complexity of the problem that we're working on.
I guess that's an interesting question. What I know that ThoughtWorks certainly works on a wide range of different types of projects. And you said earlier on that there were some projects where you didn't think these tools were particularly helpful. I think you said that. Have you seen enough yet to be able to categorize those? Could you say, I wouldn't use this for, you know, deeply complicated code dealing with genomics or something like that, or you know, yes, it's perfect for building the square kilometer array.
Yeah, nothing specific like that, but I usually go through a few criteria of like what it depends on, that if it's useful to you or not. And we already talked about experience of the developer. It depends on that. Depends on the complexity of the problem, definitely, I think. Kind of like thinking about like how probable is it that this type of pattern that I'm working on is actually in the training data, right? It also depends on the tech stack, of course. Like how common is this, again, this language, this library in the training data, you know, is it, and if it's not very common, kind of like testing out if that is, if you can mitigate that by the code that you have open in your code base, right? Yes. So that it can pick up on the local stuff. So it will work a lot better for Python or JavaScript or Java than for something else. A colleague was telling me the other day that, I think he was working on a code base that was a mix of Java and Kotlin and was also using different versions of some Spring library or something. And he's like, oh, it keeps getting confused about like which version or which do I want to use Kotlin or Java? And I was like, oh yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe that's not so useful. I was also talking to a team that was mostly working with a proprietary library, an internal library in that organization. And they also said it's not that useful for us because it's just not in the training data. So
at the moment it's at the level of kind of the technical constraints, I suppose, of the familiarity. I assume that will change again, thinking, extrapolating forward a little bit. I suppose what's necessary for that to change is increasing the size of the context window for the AI so that they can learn a little bit more. Go and read the documentation on this library and then come back and tell me how to use it, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's the context window, but not just that. I mean, what almost all of these tools are using is this retrieval augmented generation technique, right? And, you know, if like to the listeners, if you haven't gotten into Gen AI yet, but you're a developer, you know, that's maybe the one thing that you should start looking at, retrieval augmented generation and what that means, because it's used all over the place. Copilot does it as well. And what it means is, you know, you don't go and fine tune your model or you feed the model with your whole code base, but you have this like search step before. I was talking about that before, right? That is often about search a lot, right? So a tool like GitHub Copilot will index your code base locally in your IDE in a way that they can do what's also called a similarity search. So when I ask it, like, where am I implementing XYZ? It does this like natural language search on the index code base in your IDE. It picks out the things that it thinks are relevant to the question, and that's what it sends to the large language model. So it's kind of like the information you send is filtered down beforehand. And that's like a very common way that even without touching the model, just using a plain foundation model, you can kind of like, again, orchestrate this context, right? And try and feed it, like enrich the prompt that you're sending with your local information. Maybe that's also a way to actually nudge it to be familiar with your specific library, right? That you have by opening certain files or by being able to adjust the prompt and describe examples. Like I was giving GitHub Copilot that Mermaid.js example, and it immediately could pick up on that and do it, right? Even though it obviously wasn't in the training data.
Yeah. I was interested in that. I'm sure that I was doing the wrong things, but I was using GitHub Copilot for a little you know, side gig project just for fun, really. And I was trying to build some tools to help. I was looking at building some performance measurement stuff for as a plugin for unit tests, so you could do simple benchmarking, performance benchmarking in unit tests. And it was really struggling to get the concept of what I was trying to do. And I felt like I was really fighting it. And I couldn't work out whether that was me not explaining what I was trying to achieve well enough, or it not being familiar with some of the esoteric bits of the Java API and the intricacies of JUnit that I was trying to play with.
I definitely think it's still important that the developer still understands the problem.
Yeah.
Let's say, right? So I've also, like, on my martinfowler.com memos, I'm also writing about different examples of, like, a median function that I had it generate. So a pretty straightforward thing, right? Yeah. And then with one of the functions, it turned out it didn't work. It failed when you gave it an uneven length of an array or something.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a test for that at first. And to understand that this is an important test case, you have to understand how median calculation works, right? To understand that it makes a difference if the number of numbers you give it is even or uneven, right? Mm-hmm. Or a few weeks ago, I was actually trying to very quickly build a Minecraft plugin for my 12-year-old godson. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to create a labyrinth. And I just had ChatGPT generate, like, some labyrinth algorithm for me. And I had no idea how it worked.
Yeah.
And then I was really struggling to adapt it to what I was trying to do. I was just trial and error, and it was like long feedback loop. And so I think it can really get you into trouble if you don't really know the problem that you're working on, right? So maybe that's the opposite of what you were just saying. But
I understood the problem. I'm not sure I was communicating it very well to Copilot.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. So do you think that you've got a kit bag of advice for steering people to use these things more effectively? What are your kind of rules of thumb, your guide rails that you find inform your use of this to get more successful outcomes?
I mean, like I said, there's so many use cases, so it's kind of really hard to have just a few, right? But let's say, like, with coding assistants in particular, it's definitely kind of like thinking about what files I have open, right? And also when we do prompting in all situations, if it's in Copilot chat or like for user story writing or something, I always think of like this idea of a large language model as a neural net and kind of like neurons. And I always try to think of the trigger words. What are the words that will steer it in the right direction in this net, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all about like kind of closeness of terms, as far as I understand it, right? So I try to like activate the right neurons. So I make sure that I mention the word software. It's just as a very simple example, because there are some words that mean something very different in the software space than they mean in other domains, right?
Yeah.
So I always think of that, and not so much about like having the perfectly phrased sentence as when I talk to somebody, but which words am I using? And again, like, it's always about like the how can I put together the context, the data of what I'm doing, right?
So let's ask a provocative question. What do you think will be the first software jobs to be replaced by AI?
Now we're getting into the speculative part, right?
Yeah.
Like, where is this going, right? I mean, I always think about in terms of like the potential that I think in terms of how much AI can help is also different in different areas of software, right? Like, to take a simple example, backend versus web frontend, right? When we write backend code, like let's say like a relatively simple CRUD type HTTP API, right? The patterns how to do that are very well established, right? And I don't know how many times I've written an application with like controller, service, repository, query to the database, right? Large language models are quite good at generating SQL queries as well, right? So maybe something like that at some point, like to just generate that with an agent and execute it, I can imagine that much more than having an AI by itself do web front end code, because the browser is just like, illogical, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we've been struggling with the browser platform for such a long time. Like, it always goes in circles, trying to improve what we're doing, state management, server side, you know, client side, all of that, right? So that's a lot messier, right? Also for us as humans to even describe like what we want to do. So just to give that as an example, I think there's, you know, areas where patterns are a lot more established than in other areas are probably going to get more powerful AI support sooner rather than the others.
That's interesting. I must admit, I think I probably would have said the other way around, but I'm slightly biased. I wrote some code back in the early 1990s. I was working on a research project, and we were building something that was kind of like a weird forerunner of microservices. They were called cooperative business objects. And we auto-generated user interfaces. We could design an object that represented a concept. And from that, I wrote the code that would just generate a user interface that would work for it. Mm. And that seemed... It was an interesting project and an interesting thing to do. So I was thinking that might be more.
Mm. I mean, in web development work, I always think of like this 80-20 thing, right? You often get 80% of the way in like 20% of the time. And then there are all these like intricate little pitfalls and like connecting things with each other and weird bugs. And so that's why maybe that's my view on the browser. So
it's an interesting problem. That's so your bet would be on back-end services for simple web apps.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, don't name me down on it. I know that, I mean, the most impressive demos right now are in the space of low code, right?
Yeah.
Because low code application platforms are already at a very, very high abstraction level. So like jumping from like a natural language high level description to what a low code platform can do is actually like a relatively short kind of way. But then of course you also have a low code application with all of the constraints, like the lack of control that you know, it only maybe works for certain kinds of domains, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe even like the ones where you already don't have to do much as a developer are also going to be the ones where AI can take even more work away from you. Whereas the ones where developers today have to spend a lot of work, conversely, then, you know, you actually get a lot less out of it today.
So technically intricate things in obscure problem domains are probably the safer jobs. I think that's what we're saying.
And also as developers, like, it's definitely going in the direction of just focusing a lot more on design and, you know, all of those things, and not so much on the, you know, syntax and, you know, the intricate details of how you plug things together, which, could also be seen as a positive development, right? Because that's also sometimes the more interesting
thing. Well, that seems to me like the short-term promise. I assume that one day all code will be written by AIs unless people are doing it for fun. Mm. Any serious production problems will be done by AIs because they'll be better at it than we will. I assume that comes one day. But in the shorter term, the more immediate, the next big step, it seems to me, is what we've been talking about in terms of them getting more incremental and being able to evolve solutions. One of my hesitations with the current generation of AI tools is very similar to my hesitation with low code, is that it doesn't adopt any of the engineering principles that we've learned over the years. So there's no version control. You can't step back to a stable version of what went before. You can't even if you version control the prompt of your AI, you're not going to generate the same code the next time. And so that's not a very solid foundation on which to build the growth of a complex system that's pushing the bounds of the capability of the system, whether that's a human or a machine.
That's also why I think like AI by its, like, or I should say a large language model by itself will not get us there, right? So it's a combination of things. Maybe it's even like an evolution of of the algorithms. And also, I think, I mean, I'm also, even though I'm in this space like now so much at the moment, right, I'm having a hard time like speculating and imagining, right? Because I also think that if we want to get there, it will also be with architecture and technical approaches that are different from how we're building things today, right? So we have to kind of step out of the box and think about, you know, a future where there's not a Spring application in the back end and a JavaScript application in the front end, but maybe in 10, 15 years, will things maybe look different? So because we've like come up with new architecture patterns, new design patterns that actually help us leverage AI better, so we can reduce the amount of work that we have to put into it as humans, right? And that's a lot harder to imagine when you've been doing things a certain way for 20 or 30 years, right?
Yeah, but that's part. So I mean, that step, that important step, it seems to me that we're both, I think, envisaging is a really interesting one in terms of moving us forward, because it's that step of them being smart enough to be able to try something out and change things incrementally and evaluate their solutions to understand where to go next. It's this model of, you know, at that point they are becoming automated engineers rather than just automated code generators. That's a very different kind of thing and a very different set of problems to solve. Problem solving being one of those problems. So, you know, applying those sorts of those more disciplined approaches to doing things seems to me they must do that at some point, like, you know, however smart they are.
I mean, there's and that was also the discussion around Devon that we were talking about before, that makes a plan for how to implement things. And the company behind Devon says that they're focusing on reasoning, right? And I mean, I'm not a data scientist, so I'm always a bit confused. But there's this like way of describing to a certain level, large language models can do some form of like quote unquote again reasoning, right? I think not technically. But they have this emergent property where they can, you know, do something that looks like reasoning to a certain extent. But it's not really reasoning. It's just almost like a coincidence, right? So there's probably better AI, better approaches to AI that will be able to do that better. And maybe large language models can never quite get there. Yeah. There's definitely also, it seems like there's a lot of research into looking into like how can you, certain models are a lot better at it than others. GPT-4 is, as far as I know, still one of the best ones at doing this type of thing, like reasoning about what questions should I ask the user about the user story.
Yes.
You know, that's like a form of reasoning, like what information are we still missing, right?
Yes.
So if we can get that up, or, you know, have different AI that can do that, that's, like you said, that's definitely one of the key things. Yeah.
And I'm riding another of my hobby horses now, but I think that the Devon thing, if they're looking about making it build a plan, I think that's a mistake. I've just made a video about Kinefin, so, you know, the difference between complex systems, complex adaptive systems, and complicated systems. And I believe software development is always a complex adaptive system. And so what we should be doing is we should be working experimentally. So if the AI is going to take over from us, or really raise that level of abstraction to the degree where, you know, we're just giving it what we want it to do and it does all the technicalities of building the software, then it's got to be able to do that kind of thing. It's got to be able to design experiments to carry out as part of the way to make progress, because that's what you do in a complex adaptive system. It's what works, and that's really what I mean. So when I talk about engineering, I don't mean having some Gantt chart.
I mean, one of the demos for Devon, and I think there was some controversy about the demos afterwards. So, you know,
they were sped up.
I didn't look at that.
Yeah.
But one of the demos was showing something where it made a plan where it was actually putting log statements into the program and then running them on the terminal, looking at the output from the terminal, and then making quote unquote decisions about how to continue, which would be kind of like what you were saying, right? Yeah. But
maybe. We're fast approaching the end of our time. That was an interesting exploration. Is there anything else that we should have talked about that we haven't talked about so far, do you think? I know you've been doing things at ThoughtWorks with some interesting tools, and I was really interested in the stuff that you were talking about earlier. I don't think we talked about it enough, about the using these kind of, for want of a better term, AI tools for other aspects of the software development approach. There's lots of scope for that.
It's other like things that I usually have conversations with people about. So like the thing about data quality orchestrating the context and all of those things, right? Which has a lot of potential, because you can have some people who know these things actually help others out by giving them this context.
Yeah.
Then another thing is the journey is the destination, like this like simplification of, you know, software delivery as a bunch of artifacts that feed into each other. So not to forget about that, right? Also this like, you know, if you're a skeptic, like thinking of the potential of combining large language models with all of these other things and, you know, putting them together to solve the task. So that is something that I always keep in mind when I'm skeptical about like the potential.
Yeah, but we've certainly been playing with using some of the AI tools to organize information a lot. So things like making some of my video content more searchable, but all sorts of different things. And it's really an enormous help for those sorts of things. It really takes toil out of, you know, the fact that you can have a machine, you know, generate text from a video recording, and, you know, that's searchable. And then you can have another machine interpret what that means is and search for keywords and in context and find the definitions of terms and things like that. It's all really, really easy to do with these tools, and would take a human being a very long time to do, to trawl through all of that data. So there are lots of things like that, I think, as well, that are kind of on the edges but a bit outside of what we've been talking about largely. So we're certainly living through interesting times.
Yeah.
Anyway, Birgitte, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to talk to us all today and give us the benefit of your experience. Thank you for listening. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review.